21-1851, Provisor v. Weber. Good morning. Mr. Babbitt, whenever you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Michael Babbitt for the appellant and patent owner. Your Honors, the Board's surprise claim construction in its final written decision was an error of law that infected the patentability analysis here and harmed Provisor. The parties went through the entire IPR process with one common agreed understanding of the so-called multi-fill claim limitation and the related patentability issues. And the Board's sua sponte claim construction at the last possible moment pulled the rug out from underneath the parties on that issue. It substituted the Board's new, overbroad understanding of the claims
for the parties' agreed construction. Wait, so are you saying the Board initially said this claim construction is multi-fill and then they changed it to piece by piece the written decision? That's not how things went down here, right?
No, the board didn't address this claim construction issue.
And
in the
where did you address it? In your preliminary response, did you argue that the claims were limited to multi-fill?
No, Your Honor. The way this all played out, if we start from the beginning, we have the petition. In our preliminary response, we were arguing about a different claim construction issue. This is actually about multi-row deposition. Then it was not about whether we're depositing two pieces at a time. So when we see the appellees citing these issues, they're taking this out of context from the preliminary decision and the institution decision. And what you see, if you go and you look at our preliminary patent owner response, we were arguing about a different part of the claim. We weren't arguing about this multi-fill part of the claim. And then when we get to the institution decision, the board actually said there's not a dispute between the parties. Where the patent owner first raised these issues is in the patent owner response after the institution decision. After we had the benefit of the institution decision, we raised this issue with respect to the missing limitation, with respect to the missing multi-fill limitation in the patent owner response. The petitioner reply agreed with the claim construction. And so during the trial, there was no dispute about any of this. Everyone agreed that the multi-fill limitation was the proper construction of the claim. This didn't come up in the SIR reply. It didn't come up in any pre-evidentiary motions. It didn't come up at the hearing. It was a big surprise to us when we got to the final written decision, and the board said, your agreed construction, which you guys have proceeded on through the entire trial, was wrong, and now we're going to give you a new construction.
But by your own acknowledgement, you were heard on the issue in your brief, in your response. Is there anything more that you would have said?
Well, absolutely. We raised the multi-fill issue. If that ended up being a point of contention between the parties, then there's a whole world of evidence.
You raised the issue, or did Weber raise the issue, the multi-fill issue?
The multi-fill claim construction was first provided by us, the patent owner, in the patent owner response. So we raised that issue. We said under the proper claim construction, there is no obviousness. The petitioner agreed with the claim construction and they made their obviousness arguments. But if we knew that that was going to be an issue, there's a whole that would have all proceeded completely differently. We would have had replies. We would have had expert depositions. There would have been evidentiary motions. We could have addressed that at the hearing. And we were deprived of that opportunity by not knowing that there was ever going to be an issue.
The real key word here is whether it was simultaneous, right? And Weber, in fact, is the person that used simultaneous first. And you seized upon that. You seized upon that in your SIR reply, and you only said that the claims required depositing multiple drafts at the last time, once in passing in each response. I mean, I'll concede there may have been some confusion, but I don't think it was the board's fault. I think it wasn't clear that you were really disputing or the simultaneousness of this. But you had an opportunity. I mean, this was in the game, right?
No, I mean, it's a completely different obviousness argument with the different claim construction, Your Honor, which has never developed in this IPR trial because the board sprung this on us at the last minute. And I don't think it's fair to say that this was something that, you know, we always had an opportunity to address. When we do look at the preliminary response, which I think the appellee is focused on, and this is at Appendix 1721, this is the table of contents from the preliminary response, you can see this is about The while said first and second rows are still in the fill station claim limitation, a different claim limitation than what we're dealing with here. We're talking, it's about multiple row deposition, not about multiple piece and multiple portion deposition.
You've already told us you did eventually address the very claim construction dispute that is before us now, correct?
Yes, the claim construction dispute is addressed in the patent owner response.
Can I move on to another argument that you have to confront, which I think is the board went on nonetheless to analyze obviousness based on your own preferred construction. Isn't that right?
Right, and that's where we get to a substantial evidence issue. And I don't think the board has substantial evidence for that obviousness finding.
If we think that there is substantial evidence for that, do we even have to resolve the claim construction question?
Well, so there's a substantial evidence issue and there's an APA issue, actually, with the way that the board did this, because they basically did this backdoor obviousness analysis. The entire proceeding was about whether this Hansberg reference actually discloses the multi-fill limitation. And then...
just to be clear, I don't want to cut you off, but I thought the APA issue was related to the failure of you're not having notice on this multi-fill claim construction issue.
There's two parts to the APA issue. That's the first part of the APA issue. With respect to the surprise claim construction. And then the second part of the AP issue is this what I'm calling this backdoor obviousness issue, where the petition says Hansberg discloses this limitation. Again, we proceed through the entire proceeding based on that issue and address that evidence. Essentially what happened is we put in this evidence of the missing limitation. Then in reply, the petitioners changed their arguments to try to do this backdoor obviousness case. They put in evidence of common sense and, the background art, and you actually see the board then relying on that in the final written decision.
Did
so that is a violation.
Did you respond to those arguments? Did you get a chance to respond to those arguments?
Not in substance, Your Honor. We weren't able to put in additional evidence because, again, we have this issue of it being addressed in reply.
I don't mean additional evidence, just responding, because it seems to me that one of the problems you have is that even if we accept what you're saying is true, that we're dealing with harmless error, because it seems that the board ultimately did consider the statements that you're raising today.
And we don't have harmless error.
Did the board hear your arguments? Now, I know you had a chance to present evidence, but if your side of the story is accepted, then even assuming you had provided expert testimony to bolster, to support your argument, seems that the PTAB would have found the same way anyway.
And I don't think that's right, Your Honor, respectfully. And this is the Qualcomm case that we know well from last year, where the board held that it would not be harmless if a petitioner is able to put in additional evidence here. We saw in Qualcomm the board talking about, or this court talking about removing an element of proof and not giving...
Now, Qualcomm has two parts, right? Notice and then opportunity, mm-hmm. opportunity to be heard. It could be that here there was no notice, but it seems to me that there was an opportunity to be heard, that you had that.
And I don't, respectfully, Your Honor, I don't think that's right. I think we have a bigger policy problem here with the PTAB, actually, where we have these, you know, clever petitioners that put in a vague obviousness theory at the outset in their petition, and then we have this shifting sands approach to litigation, where they're then able to backfill their petitions on the reply, put in additional evidence, put in additional expert evidence, and that puts a patent owner in a really difficult spot. In this case, we filed a motion to strike on this. And it was denied. What else are we supposed to do? How are we supposed to address that evidence after the reply stage where all we have left is a surreply to make attorney argument? We were able to make attorney argument about claim construction. Well, you can't develop the expert record, depose their experts on these issues and develop the evidentiary record in a proper way. So
what exactly are you saying? Because there were experts on both sides here, right?
That's right.
And it was dealing with the substantial evidence issue about the multi-fill limitation.
Mm-hmm.
So what precisely are you saying you weren't on notice on one of the arguments they made? Or where's the failure of notice here? Notice
so,
of what?
Two notice problems. One is with the surprise claim construction that nobody knew about until the final
decision. We're already past that.
Okay. Two is with this backdoor obviousness case where we change it from in the petition, what does the reference disclose? What does it actually disclose? That's what we were addressing in the panel in response, what Hansberg actually discloses. And I don't think there's any substantial evidence that Hansberg discloses depositing two at a time, which we can get to that. But then when they changed that to an obviousness argument that it would have been obvious for Hansberg to have two of them, that's not proper. That's beyond the scope of the IPR. That's beyond the scope of the proceeding. It's beyond the scope of the petition.
I'm really not understanding what backdoor obviousness is. When you're making obviousness, part and parcel of that is what one skilled in the art, how they would have read the prior art and whether it covered this. So I don't understand. I mean, how could you have been surprised that that was the position they were taking? That's inherent in making the obviousness allegation.
When we look at the petition, and this is at Appendix 214, the only argument in the petition about Hansberg was that Hansberg, quote, discloses this limitation, whether it actually discloses. There was no reason to combine. There was no expectation of success with respect to that limitation and that subject matter. We made our argument that this is a missing limitation in the patent owner response. And then the petitioner transformed this argument into an obviousness argument. And they started to say, oh, well, it's common sense. And there's the background out that supports this. And the board actually relied on that in their decision. I believe it's Appendix 30 or 29. Where they refer to common sense and they refer to the background art, which is not the argument in the petition. The issue is not about actually disclosing.
Counsel, I'm struggling a little with how much notice we have of this argument on appeal. I think I see two sentences on page 40 of your opening brief. Is that the full extent of the development of this backdoor obviousness?
No, I'm using my, clever phrase of backdoor obviousness here. That's not in the briefs. But this APA violation is actually, I think, very much tied to the substantial evidence argument, which is, again, that there is not substantial evidence to what Hansberg actually discloses.
Okay, but that's not an APA violation, right? Or at least you're saying there's an APA violation in addition to lack of substantial evidence. In addition to the claim construction.
They're tied together, Your Honor. And so there's a legal failing.
Well, I wanted to know your argument about lack of notice about what Hansberg disclosed. Where would I have found that in preparation for today?
And that's in our APA portion that you cited. It was the last paragraph, with a cite to the M&K holding case, which I think that case is very instructive, Your Honor, because what we saw there is, this court reverting on the situation where there was an obviousness argument in the petition for this dependent claim 3, and the board transformed that into an anticipation argument. So they transformed it from, is it obvious, to what does the prior art disclose? I think it's actually even more of an issue here when you're transforming it from, what does the prior art actually disclose, to an obviousness issue. So that's the APA issue there, coming right from M&K Holdings.
Okay, you're into your rebuttal. So you
all right, I'll save my time, please. Thank you.
May it please the court, John Wright for the appellee Weber. So I think I'll address the two APA arguments that seem to be at issue in the opening argument here. So with respect to the claim construction APA argument, there is no or was no sua sponte construction by the board in its final written decision. Its construction was actually perfectly consistent with what it said about the claims in the decision on institution. And to the extent that there was any confusion in the decision on institution, it was an issue of provisor's own making. So perhaps the best evidence in the decision on institution that the board rejected provisor's exclusion of piece-by-piece deposition from the claim term that we're talking about is at Appendix 1940. And there, the board, in the context of addressing the Hawley-Matic reference, and this is at the top of 1940. This is the institution decision on the 936 patent, but we can also find it in the institution decision on the 513 patent. At the top, the board says...
What's the page number
again? 1940. Okay. And they're addressing Holly-Matic, which I think there's no dispute unambiguously has piece-by-piece deposition. The board said that the patent owner offers no explanation why serial depositing of multiple food objects in multiple rows would not meet the recited claim language. Even if we assume that Hansberg-Holly-Matic combination is limited to single-item deposition, as the patent owner contends. So the board rejected the position there, and it rejected it again. In the context of the 513 patent as well. So additionally, my sense is that Provisor's kind of shifted its position on appeal as well, because it says fairly clearly in its opening brief on page 14 that Provisor argued in its preliminary responses that the claims as properly constructed required multiple drafts to be deposited simultaneously in multiple rows while the web remained stationary. And now they seem to be arguing that, oh, we didn't make that argument in the preliminary response. We didn't make that until our patent owner response. So my overall point here is that there is a clear line all the way through the preliminary response where Provisor argued for, or at least attempted to argue for, a simultaneous multi-fill. The decision on institution, which rejected that position, and then the final written decision, which again was consistent with the institution decision. So there's just no shift in the board's position all the way through on the claim construction argument, and that frankly eviscerates the APA argument with respect to claim construction. So happy to answer additional questions on the APA claim construction argument.
So move on to the substantial evidence APA question.
Right. So the Provisor in its opening brief is for this APA violation is relying on the board's decision at Appendix 41. And I'm looking at page 40 of their blue brief, where this is where they're arguing that the board, at the bottom of page 40 of the blue brief, the board held that Hansberg and Holly-Matic renders obvious, rather than discloses, the multi-fill limitation. And they cite, for example, to Appendix 41. But if you go to Appendix 41, that is simply the board's kind of summary conclusion of the obviousness case. So if you look at Appendix 41, I think that what they're pointing to is at the bottom, the conclusion for Claim 1, where they say that Hansberg and Holly-Matic render Claim 1 is obvious. But it doesn't say there that, oh, it's the multi-fill limitation that's obvious. And in fact, if you go back to Appendix 32 in the board's final written decision on the 513 patent, there in the middle of that page, the board says, and this is at the kind of the last sentence of the middle paragraph, but we further find that the DE915 application supports that Hansberg teaches or suggests both the multi-fill deposition and piece-by-piece deposition as alternatives. So the board found, and substantial evidence supports, that Hansberg discloses or at least suggests simultaneous multi-fill deposition into rows. And that finding is supported by substantial evidence, and if that is the case, then this court can affirm on direct appeal. Okay. So, absent questions on the direct appeal, I'd like to turn to Weber's cross-appeal argument. So with respect to the reverse fill claims, as we're referring to those claims on cross-appeal, the board erred analytically because it premised its decision of non-obviousness solely on its observation and evidence that said that the reverse fill embodiment of the Hansberg-Holly-Matic combination is less efficient and requires more steps than what I'll call the normal fill Hansberg-Holly-Matic combination. And that was the combination, of course, that Weber put forth that successfully invalidated most of the claims in the patent. Finding is not sufficient to support non-obviousness, because the board did not evaluate the motivations to combine that Weber put forth for Hansberg-Holly-Matic for claim one.
I guess I may be missing something in the record, so maybe it's on me. But it seems to me that notwithstanding whatever the law is, the argument you made for motivation to combine was that it was efficiency, full stop. And so the board was fully, it seems to me, within its rights to say, well, we don't agree that it's more efficient. Indeed, it's much less efficient because it's all this convoluted changing stuff. So we're rejecting your claim. I mean, what's wrong with that? They relied on the argument you were making for motivation and rejected it. And it's a substantial evidence review of that conclusion, is it not?
On the facts and on motivation to combine, that's a question of fact, correct. But if the board kind of footfaulted in its application of the law, then of course that's reviewed de novo.
Well, what's the footfault?
So the footfault is that the board, so if you look at Appendix 27, this is the final written decision for the 513 patent, the board lists the motivations to combine that Weber put forward. Mm-hmm. It's in that paragraph at the bottom of page 27 and over to 28. And there, on page 27, there are four motivations to combine there. None of which, well, at least three of which do not implicate the overall direction that the conveyor moves when depositing. So, for example, the first one is this is the second sentence in that paragraph, forming arrays with multiple rows and columns was an efficient way to organize containers. That's true irrespective of whether you're looking at the forward fill or the reverse fill combinations. The second one is that forming multiple rows in containers during each dwell time increases the number of containers that can be formed and improves the amount of product that can be loaded. Again, that motivation is there irrespective of whether it's a forward fill or reverse fill combination for Hansberg and Holly-Matic. Same thing with at the bottom of the page. It says petitioner also contends that using containers formed in webs rather than preformed trays, as in Holly-Matic, is less expensive. Again, that's irrespective of the overall motion of the conveyor in the depositing steps. So the board simply didn't appreciate that all of those motivations are there irrespective of the overall motion of the conveyor. And then when it evaluated the reverse fill combination, it failed to do that kind of balancing of pros and cons that the law requires. It simply said, oh, the reverse fill is not as efficient as the forward fill.
Well, it said that adding an advancement step would be less efficient and undesirable because it would require advancing the conveyor then retracting the part that supports the food, then advancing it. I mean, I guess I'm not seeing you're saying they had to, you know, this is a lot of case with a lot of issues, and they couldn't take you at your word and say, no, we're looking at this, and it's less efficient. You were making an efficiency argument. This is less efficient. I don't understand what more was required in terms of balancing this and balancing the four different sub-arguments you were making. Just help me out here, because I'm not getting it.
So I guess there's two principles of law that come into play here. The first is that a combination that is perhaps inferior or not the most desired combination or the preferred combination is still not inapt for purposes of obviousness.
I take that point. We've all read KSR numerous times, but that doesn't mean that the board is foreclosed from taking the argument that the petitioner is making on motivation, which is this is more efficient using efficiency, and saying we reject your argument on motivation and therefore you lose. That's not that kind of analytical framework is not foreclosed by KSR, is it?
No, because the motivation to combine can come from any number of places post-KSR. The point is that all of the motivations to combine that the board accepted with respect to the forward fill embodiment of Hansberg Holly-Matic are equally applicable to the reverse fill Hansberg Holly-Matic. And the overall, again, the overall motion of the conveyor does not detract from those motivations. And I think it was incumbent on the board to at least say something about those motivations, which it had accepted throughout the case, and weighed those against the inefficiency that the reverse fill had over the forward fill combination. It didn't even evaluate the reverse fill combination over the prior art standing alone. Again, all of those motivations are still applicable, and that was the kind of the footfault in the board's analytical reasoning. I see him into my rebuttal time.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honor, I'll just briefly address the cross-appeal issue, because I think your question, Judge Prost, got right at the heart of it. There's no error of law here. The board did a purely factual analysis on obviousness. The petitioner said that things were, that the combination would have made it efficient, and the board rejected that. You can see that admission from them in the red brief on page 66.
But what about his point about the board should have taken into account all the other motivation arguments that were present in the main appeal?
I think the board considered that information, and it rejected it on a factual basis. There's no legal issue. As you say, KSR is a flexible analysis. The board applied KSR in that situation and found that there was non-obviousness on those claims. With the moments I have left, I would like to just actually get to an issue which I think I haven't raised, which is the substantial evidence issue, because I think it's important of Hansberg. When we talk about Hansberg, the issue is, does...
Wait,
is,
I'm sorry, where are we back to the main appeal now?
Yes, Your Honor.
And is, you're...
May I?
Well, you're making an argument you didn't make in your earlier statements.
I'd like to address the substantial evidence issues that we touched on. So Hansberg, there's not substantial evidence that Hansberg actually teaches the multi-fill limitation. The board only cited the two things with respect to Hansberg. They cited the fact that there's empty lanes and that there's empty receptacles. So empty lanes and empty receptacles doesn't tell anything about how these things are actually deposited. There's actually a portion of Hansberg at column 4 into column 5, which starts with the manner in which the sliced food is delivered will now be described. That's the evidence of how Hansberg deposits things, and consistently throughout that, it's all one at a time. So okay. There's not substantial evidence.
Okay. It's a little problematic because these are arguments you didn't raise when you were first up here, and they have an opportunity to respond on the cross appeal, but not on that. So it's a little troubling. But anyway, thank you. We have your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Just one very brief point on the cross appeal. The appropriate yardstick for measuring obviousness for the reverse fill combination was not the preferred combination of the forward fill that Weber put forth to invalidate most of the claims. The proper yardstick is the prior art as it existed at the time. And again, all of those motivations that motivated Hansberg and Holly-Matic coming together are equally applicable to the reverse fill combination, and they're just not tied to the direction that the conveyor moves when depositing drafts. And the board's failure to appreciate that and evaluate those motivations is the error.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank both sides, and the case is submitted.